start with our motivation. And really come back to what it means to take a body under the influence of affliction, and karma. Remember the nature of this body, how it gets born, ages, gets sick and dies without our control, without our choice, and that our consciousness is bound to this body by the force of ignorance. When we think of how much outright suffering that produces, as well as the dukkha of change and the dukkha of pervasive conditioning, then we generate a strong wish to stop this cycle, to be free of this kind of body, and to have some choice. For example, choosing, like the arhats do, to remain in meditative equipoise on emptiness, or choosing, like the bodhisattvas and Buddhists do, to take a different kind of body and manifest in the world for the benefit of sentient beings. So let's generate that kind of wish to break this cycle, and particularly to gain the body of a Buddha that can tirelessly work for the benefit of sentient beings with wisdom, compassion, and power. So again, this doesn't mean that we hate our body, it just means we realize it is what it is and stop the decoration about it. It's saying it's the source of pleasure and so wonderful and everything. And, you know, just really see what it means to have a body under the influence of afflictions and karma and the difficulties, the suffering, the pain that it brings to us and to all living beings, and then to generate that determination to be free and to help all other sentient beings to be free as well. So I wanted to start this evening. Some of the students gave a little bit of feedback, so I thought to share it with you. So one person was commenting about that, you know, we're on the chapter about arrogance now, and saying that arrogance makes no sense as we're totally dependent on others. Okay, and then how she was thinking about how arrogance manifests in relationship to how we interact with the environment. And so we take ownership of a land, we cultivate it, and take what we think we deserve from the earth. And as long as we treat the soil so that what we take out, you know, we think it can reproduce itself, which of course the minerals can't. You know, we keep taking and taking and taking. And that at a certain point the earth runs out because of our arrogance, and we haven't really respected what the earth can and can't do. Okay. When we respect the earth and we make sure that we nourish it back, so, and the cycle of nature continues so that we can continue to grow food. But now we just take what we can get and don't worry about it. And then we also put a lot of chemicals into the earth. So thinking that we're kind of the rulers and the king, you know, like that, how we get arrogant. And so, you know, we talk about this a lot, but to really restrain ourselves and be more humble in face of the environment in our daily life takes some work, because it may mean really looking at how we use water, and do we need to use as much water as we use? Do we need to clean things as often as we clean them? Yeah. And to really look at where we drive, and do we need to drive to all those places, or can we carpool? Can we walk? Okay, so she's saying our arrogance towards the earth can make us sick and even cause death. And so we kill our own self through our arrogance. Yeah? And you can really see that when you think of climate change. Okay, so it's not the earth or the weather that's doing that to us, it's us. Yeah? So actually we are the servant of the earth, like the king is the servant of the people. Mm. Yeah, and the earth can survive without us, but we totally depend on the earth. And so we should really treat the environment, the earth, in a respectful way, and not with our short-term, narrow-minded view that brings about disharmony with the environment. So I thought that was very good, to really... We've been using the example of a king, somebody who's powerful, but to really generalize that to our attitude in general, how we look at not only the earth and the environment, but how we look at other species, and how we think that, animals are there for us to eat or for us to use for labor, and we don't think about the feelings of those animals. So talking about animals, that brings us into the topic, the questions that came last week at the end about people saying that when an organ has been transplanted, then, So somebody wrote me about that and, had read the book. The book is called The Heart's Code, Tapping the Wisdom and Power of Our Heart Energy. And the author there, mentioned some transplant experiences. But it made me think, we all think, oh, that's kind of cool, you transplant somebody's heart and then, maybe that way you could get a better personality or something like that. you adopt the some of the habits of the other person. But it made me think that I've also heard about eating meat, that, when you eat meat, you are taking the energy of the animal, and since animals, their chief character is of ignorance, that you're taking on kind of that ignorant energy by eating meat. So if you think it's kind of cool that, that it happens with when you transplant a heart, then think of what you're getting when you eat meat, and that the meat goes into every cell of your body. Yeah. So this person, the second person also, commented on that, also said that one thing that isn't covered in the third chapter of the 400 stanzas is what to do with our unclean bodies when we are no longer using them. Okay, so at the time, the cremation ghat was the method of choice. Today there are carbon dioxide emissions to consider. Yeah. So I think that's a very important point. That Time magazine just did an article about cremation and saying how many more people are choosing to cremate the cremation now, and how much cheaper it is than burying, and doesn't take the land, and for burying, and you don't need the same kind of vault and hearse and all this rigmarole that people do. So in one way it seems like a good idea. The other way, when you use so much gas in the West, there's you're it can be really polluting. One of my, my old college friend, roommate was doing research on that and found out that cremation actually is not very good for the environment. So she started doing research on, I don't know what you call it, but it's where they just put the body in the earth without having a coffin. You just dig a hole, natural burial, something like that. So I don't know what the law says about that. It's funny how the government regulates what you do with a dead body. It's so strange, isn't it? It's something maybe we should investigate. Although, I must say, I much prefer the idea of not having a place where the body is, because when you have a place, then people go there, and there's just the whole tendency towards reification. Whereas, with cremation, you're just gone, which is exactly, when you die, the person you were stops, and there's a continuum of the general I, but the specific I of this life ceases, and you get another specific I of your next life. And I think it's important to remember that, otherwise people make it so solid. Like they do sometimes when they talk about the incarnations of different lamas, it's as if they think it's the exact same person with the same personality, just kind of picking up and moving into another body. And it's not exactly like that, because there is no fixed personality at all. So this particular person said, I think the most beneficial thing for other sentient beings is to donate my body to medical science so that it can help educate physicians who can in turn help sentient beings. So that's something that people may want to consider, donating your body to medical science, because some people may go, oh, but my body, I want to treat it respectfully. I don't want these people dissecting it. Once we die, it's not our body. Actually, it's not even our body when we're alive. The genes came from our parents and the food came from other sentient beings. Okay? So donating to medical science is also another useful option that people can consider. And he says, has how to dispose of the body ever come up at the Abbey, other than in the context of giving it metaphorically in the course of bodhisattva practice? And so I have to say yes, that a few years ago we all sat down and we did our living wills and our spiritual wills and our worldly wills. And so many people expressed at that time what they wanted to have done with their body when it's dead. Since there's some new residents at the Abbey, I think it would be very good if we did that whole exercise again and everybody did it again and thought about it. Yeah. And also with this new information of, how to lessen our carbon imprint when this body dissolves. I mean, I would be perfectly happy to put the thing in the meadow and let the birds eat it. I wonder if the government will let you do that.
It's a public health issue.
It's a public health issue?
That's how they're wondering.
Yeah. Even though you're out in the middle of nowhere, the country's
your own body on your own land.
Yeah, it's strange. It's not even your own body. And, if you have to have something amputated or whatever, the amputated limb is no longer yours. You no longer have jurisdiction over what happens to it. The hospital has to follow government rules about what to do with your limb after they amputate it. No, you can't take it home with you. Yeah. Interesting. In Thailand, a number of monastics donate their bodies so that they can make the skeletons that they hang inside the meditation halls as a reminder of death. Yeah, I wonder if we can do that here. If the government would let us do that, to donate our bodies in that way. Yeah, find somebody who would dissolve all the tissue, because it's an, you know, people go, but it's actually very good to have this in a meditation hall. It really makes you think about death. Mm-hmm. And thinking about death is one of the primary things that motivates us to practice. So when I stayed in Thailand at one of the wats, they had a body, you know, a skeleton that was there. And they actually took us to see an autopsy, which is quite good for your practice. Yeah, really. And in Thailand, it's very acceptable to do that, you know, because the monks often do that and the government doesn't interfere in any sort of ways. Here, I don't know if they would let you go and see an autopsy. You probably have to get a lot of papers signed and the family's permission and all those kinds of things. It was so cute when we went, the monks were very concerned. There was me and a lay woman. They were so concerned that we were going to faint because one of them had fainted. And we looked at them, it's like, you're nuts. You know, we used to work in the kitchen with our mother where, you know, yeah, with chicken and beef and stuff like that. We're not going to faint seeing this. It's quite interesting how, you know, they had this image of women being, Okay, so let's go back to chapter 4 where we're talking about how to dismantle pride. So it's called, the chapter is called Abandoning Arrogance, and we're using the example of a king because a king has power and wealth and is the epitome of success in society. So if you can't relate to a king very well, you know, we can use in, you know, whatever field you're in, take the example of somebody who's very successful in that field or somebody who you admire. It might be a rock star or a movie star or a sports hero or, you know, a politician or a, you know, a Wall Street banker or, you know, I don't know, Martha Stewart or Betty Crocker or, you know, whoever it is. Yeah, Twiggy. wonder what happened to Twiggy. You don't hear about her anymore. So you know, but whoever you think is the epitome of success, you know, who has success, power, wealth, you know, fame, good reputation, and then see how that person, it's so easy for that person to become rather smug and rather arrogant because of the condition around them. So our old friend Joe Blow, who comes up with all the questions and the ifs, ands, and buts, you know, is now trying to justify why a king or a banker or a politician or a sports hero or a movie star, you know, has their arrogance is justified. So he says arrogance is appropriate because a king controls the giving and getting of wealth. Yeah? So a king, you know, controls who gets the wealth, he controls who gives the wealth. So Aryadeva responds in verse 78, when those in his care receive their due, they think of their master as the giver. When the master gives what is to be given, he thinks with conceit, I am the giver. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what that means is that when those in the king's care receive their wage for doing the services that, you know, they were employed to do, they usually think of themselves as inferior and as the king, and the king as very great and superior. And similarly, the king thinks, I am the giver, you know, I dispense the wages, and gets quite conceited about it. And Aryadeva says this kind of arrogance is really quite inappropriate, because when you pay somebody their wage, you're just giving them what is theirs. So why do you get so arrogant because you're just giving them something that they earn that you've been holding on to. Okay, so he shoots down Job Lowe's reason for why a king's arrogance is justified. So similarly, you know, if you hire people and do things, you know, if you start getting conceited, I'm their boss because I pay them, what's the big deal about paying them? You're just giving them what they earn themselves, what is rightfully theirs. There's no reason to be conceited about it. Okay, then Job Lowe says, arrogance is appropriate because a king is free to enjoy all objects. Yeah, so I don't know about you, but I remember when I was little and I thought, you know, kings and queens and princesses, they always got their way.
Hmm.
Yeah, you know, that's how you raise that. This a person with power always gets whatever they want. They always get their way. Yeah. But if you really look at the life of somebody like this, they don't always get their way. Yeah, because they depend on all the people who support them. If those other people don't support them, then they can't stay in their position of power. Yeah. Okay, so Aryadeva responds to this thing that the king is free to enjoy everything by saying that which you wrongly regard, others consider a source of suffering. Living by working for others, what causes you pleasure? Okay, so what wrongly appears as a cause for great happiness to you, O king, is actually a source of suffering to those with wisdom. So people with wisdom look at the king's life and say, whoa, is that poor person involved in a lot of misery? Okay, so since you experience uninterrupted suffering in the process of protecting large communities of people and must live by working for others, it is not a cause for happiness. Yeah. So, you know, really the king, you know, is charged with protecting all these people. And my goodness, you know, it's like a politician or a government officials, they have so much weight on them. You know, I think of the president and having the weight on your back of, you know, do we retaliate to an attack? You know, where do we send armies? How do we deal with people who are cheating? Or, you know, how do we deal with crises? How do we deal with the Wall Street bankers? You know, that if you have the, you know, at least some power to make decisions about that, it's really a lot of responsibility. And there's no clear winning situation, because you can see, at least in our country, whatever decision a political leader takes, somebody criticizes them. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, whatever decision you take, somebody is going to insult you and say that you're an idiot and you're doing the most harmful thing in the world. Yeah, so you have to endure all this criticism all the time. Yeah, and then plus you have to really think of the morality of the decisions you make. And, you know, if you retaliate and order an army to go somewhere, or if you order them to kill, then you accumulate that karma of killing. You know, somebody may be a general in the army and everybody may respect them and think, woo, they're such a big shot. But actually they accumulate so much negative karma because they're the ones that issue the orders. Yeah? The same with a gang leader, you know, that person may be very, you know, I'm the leader of the gang, but they also create much more negative karma because they're the ones who give the orders. Okay? And then also, you know, as we discussed before, whoever the leader is actually the employee of the people that they're leading, because they can't have that position unless the other people support them. And, you know, in Egypt, they just had Act Two of the revolution, and the army stepped in again, and you know, took the president and a whole bunch of his ministers and installed a new temporary government. You know, and so the, you know, President Morsi, people just, many people didn't agree with how he was governing. And so then the army justifies it, well, it's the will of the people, and they intervened and removed him from office. Yeah, so it's, I mean, such, it just happened, such a clear example that, you know, you may think that you have a lot of power, but actually you're really at the mercy of everybody else you lead. That's why I think we should sometimes have a program, you know. You remember how they used to have Queen for a day? Yeah? I think we should have Abbess for a day. And let some of you see what it's like. Yeah?
Actually, in some companies they do that. They change the jobs. There's one program I got in Germany, for example, people are going into kitchen where they give food for poor people or something, or working in old age homes. Those people who have normally managing a big company or something.
Yeah.
Turn
do the menial work. Yeah. 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 But, you know, I think to you know, because we all have so many issues with authorities and blame things on authorities and complain about authorities and we don't have any freedom, that I think it would be very interesting, you know, to have the opportunity to have that position and see what it's like and how much power you really have. You know? And even you think of, like, President Assad. You know, this guy's an ophthalmologist. He had no intention of going into politics. And he got roped into it because his elder brother died in an accident. And then he has to appease all of his father's cronies in order to remain in power and, you know, play all this politics to remain in power. And who knows what's really going to be the end of the story of President Assad. You know, it's not a fun situation, not at all. Okay, so Aryadeva says, so King, you live by working for others. So how is that a cause for happiness? Yeah. So how can this cause you pleasure when it's a source of many problems? You know, so, for example, when you have that kind of position as a king, you know, if you think, oh, I can do anything I want, then your craving goes crazy. And you crave for this, you crave for that, you order people to do all sorts of things to bring you whatever it is you want. And, you know, so you create a lot of negative karma. And then Gelsub Jay tops it off with, it's inappropriate to feel glad at being appointed to punish thieves. Yeah? And you think of it, you know, we usually think of a judge as so powerful. Yeah? Would you really want the power to punish thieves and to punish other people? You know, and the ethical element in that? It's quite difficult. Okay, then Joe Blow says, arrogance is appropriate because a king is the protector of the people. And Aryadeva says, when a ruler seems to be the protector of his people as well as the protected, why be proud because of one, and why not be free from pride because of the other? Okay, so a ruler seems to be the protector, so you say, therefore, his conceit is justified. But he's actually the protected. Yeah. So if you're going to be proud of being the protector, why aren't you free from pride and very humble when you play the opposite role and that you're the protected? Because all the populace protects you as the king. Yeah. And, you know, you can see, like, with our government, you know, you win an election and you think, oh, wow, I'm great, I have so much power. And then you need to have so many bodyguards to protect you. Yeah. Okay. So a king may feel arrogant because he protects his people, but the ruler himself is protected by the people because he could not be the king unless they protected him. Yeah. So why be arrogant because of being the protector, and why not be free from arrogance because of being the protected? Okay. And so, for example, you know, if you have two people that mutually care for each other, then, you know, one of them feeling arrogant over the other just isn't appropriate because it's a very mutual relationship. Okay. So the lion protects the forest and the forest protects the lion. Okay, then Joe Blow says, arrogance is appropriate because a king has the merit of protecting everybody like his own child, you know, like his own children. So it's appropriate for the king to be arrogant because he has so much merit that enabled him to become the protector. So verse 81, Aryadeva says, those in each caste prefer their own work. Thus a living is hard to find. If you become non-virtuous, good transmigrations will be scarce for you. Okay, so in our degenerate age, many people are not trustworthy and are engaged in not a lot of non-virtuous actions. So it's very difficult to make your living without any problems. Okay, and this goes for the king as well. So before we were saying that a king gets paid 1/6 of the wealth of, you know, each household. So if you seize as your due 1/6 of every household's wealth, you also get 1/6 of the non-virtue that they committed in creating that wealth. Okay? So, and since as a king you're practicing seizing other people's property, fortunate rebirths are going to be rather scarce for you because you're committing so much negative karma. So why are you so conceited if you're heading towards a lower realm? Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense because your power is not permanent, your status is not permanent, you're creating so much negative karma, what do you really have to be proud of? Okay, so not only does a king do many ill deeds, but he adds to those wrong actions done by others. Mm-hmm. So you can see, like, you know, in terms of karma, remember when they had that whole operation to kill bin Laden, then the people who planned the operation and who authorized it, even though they didn't do the attack, they accumulated the same karma as not just one of the Navy SEALs, but each one of them, because they were the commander who initiated the whole thing. Okay, and so the same, you know, whenever you're a leader and if you misuse that power and encourage people to create non-virtue, then you really get a lot of negative karma because of it. On the other hand, if you're a leader and you lead people to create virtue, yeah, then you get a share of their virtue. Of course, when you try and give people instructions on how to create virtue and they go, no, then I guess you miss out. Okay, then, yeah, you know, like you tell somebody, oh, it's good to set up an altar every morning, and they say, no, you know, I'm too tired in the morning. Yeah, then you don't, you know, you're doing doing something virtuous by instructing them, but you know, you would get more virtue if they actually did it. And they would actually get some virtue too if they did it.
So when there was a politician got selected, and by his selection, so he also he has his monthly salary, and this comes from the money of the citizens who support the party, mm-hmm. and he is maybe or she is emphasizing maybe a special topic like integrating, I don't know, solar energy, making it more firm in the country, and the people are deciding more to do different activities than solar, more something what is maybe not very, has not a long-term approach to a hobby. Environment, and then, but they select him because of other topics he is very good in. They support him. So does he then collect negative karma when they do something what he's not supporting necessarily?
Okay, so the question is, if you're in a position of authority, and the people under you do something that you don't support, yeah, do you accumulate that negative karma? If you didn't instruct them to do that, no, you don't. Okay? Or if you instructed them to do something else and they did that negative action anyway, then no. So, for example, like in Washington, and it goes the other way around, in Washington State, there's the capital punishment. So somebody may kill the people, and if you rejoice in that person being killed and you voted for capital punishment, then you get some karma from killing. But just because you're a resident of Washington State doesn't automatically mean that you get the karma of killing because the state did it if you don't agree with that policy at all.
Then I don't understand this first come or this meaning of 1-6, you know, that the king
because
accumulates this negative karma.
Because the king is taking the people's money, that they're not feeling good about giving it to them, to the king. Yeah. And some of the people may have earned their money, you know, doing things that are not so good. Yeah, that the king doesn't stop them from doing or whatever, you know. And then the king himself is taking their money by force. Okay. Okay, so then, because, you know, there Joe Blow had said that the arrogance is appropriate because the king has the merit of protecting everybody like his own child. And Aryadeva's response is, well, you're not, you know, you're not really creating merit by doing that, because look at your motivation. Okay. So then Joe Blow says, arrogance is appropriate because a king is the protector of his people and is independent. Is a leader independent? No. So verse 82 says, those who act at others' insistence are called fools on this earth. There is no one else at all so dependent on others as you. Okay? So someone who doesn't do work that must be done, but he can do, you know, and who only acts when others insist, is called a fool. Okay? So since a king's actions depend on the requests and the insistence of others, there is no one so dependent on others as the king. Therefore, arrogance is unjustified. Okay? So, if you're in a position of power in an organization, in a business, or whatever, you know, a lot of what you do, if you're holding that power because people elected you to that position, then you have to answer to them. You're not free to do whatever you want. You have to do what they want you to do. Okay? And so Arya's Deva is saying, you know, to think that a leader is independent, actually they're more dependent on others, you know, because they have to do what the others want. So you might be the CEO of a company, but you have to do what the shareholders want. Yeah? Or you might be the, you know, like a minister in the government or, you know, hold some kind of position, but you have to do what all the people under you want. If all the people under you want to do one thing and you don't, you're going to have a lot of problems. Okay. Then Joe Blow says, arrogance is appropriate because the protection of his people against harm from others depends on the king. So again, this whole thing, the king is the protector, the king is the big shot, he, you know, protects the people. So, you know, I'm the great and glorious protector, therefore it's appropriate to be arrogant. Yeah, or, you know, I'm the boss of the company, I'm protecting everybody's jobs, or, you know, I'm the king of the family, I'm protecting everybody in the family, whatever it is. So, Aryadeva says in verse 83, claiming protection depends on me, you take payment from the people. But if you perform ill deeds, who is equally merciless? Okay, so no one is as merciless as a king who performs ill deeds. So a lot of, you know, people who get power then do a lot of harmful things. And we see this again and again because they think that they're independent. And they think that because I have this power, because I'm protecting people, that gives me the right to do what I want. Okay? But no one is as merciless as a king who, you know, imprisons people, takes their money, relocates them without compensation, humiliates them, treats them unfairly, and so forth. And so claiming that the protection of the people depend on him, when the people don't make a large payment, the king takes it by force and performs many negative deeds such as killing. Yeah, so in olden times, if you didn't give the king the tax, you know, they came and took it by force or they killed you. Now they, you know, throw you in prison. You know, the IRS comes and gets you and throws you in prison. Yeah. Well, supposedly they do. If you're a common person, they do. If you're an important banker, they don't. Once in a while, who have gotten busted. Okay. So kings take money from the people but don't do their work. So their work is actually to protect the people, but they don't. They just take the money. They get paid and don't really protect the people. Okay, then the Joe Blow says, but if wrongdoers aren't punished, it's detrimental to others. Therefore, to protect the people, it is proper to exact punishment. So he's sticking up for the king. You know, before Aryadeva was saying, you know, the king's merciless and he's creating so much negative karma and not really doing his job of protecting people. But now Joe Blow says, yeah, but if the king didn't, you know, beat people and imprison people, then everybody else would suffer. So, you know, it's proper for the king to do that and punish people. Okay. So Aryadeva says, if people who do ill deeds should not be treated with mercy, all ordinary childish people would also not need to be protected. Okay? So, if people who do ill deeds should not be treated with mercy, okay? So, if people who do ill deeds deserve to be punished, should be beaten and flogged and treated horribly and tortured and so on because they did something wrong, then all ordinary childish people would also not need to be protected, because they all have done negative deeds, and so, you know, it would be justified for the king to punish them, so then there would be nobody to protect. Okay? So it's inappropriate to have mercy for people. If it's inappropriate to have mercy for people who have done great wrongs like killing, then ordinary people would not need to be protected with compassion, since they all engage in wrongdoing. Okay, point clear here? Yeah, and so then, therefore, all of them would deserve to be punished. Yeah, so a king should be especially merciful to wrongdoers. Otherwise, although not called a thief, he will be one because of taking payment without giving protection. Yeah? So, you know, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? That you know, if you are a government leader, you're getting paid by the people, and you don't give protection, yeah? And so you discriminate. Some people, you know, you have mercy for, and other people you have no mercy for, then you're not really protecting everybody in the populace, you know. But then Joe Blow says, well, they shouldn't be protected, they should be punished. And then the answer is, well, then you should punish everybody because everybody's done something wrong. Okay? So a king must protect, you know, the populace just as he protects his own body and wealth, even though the wrongdoers are a source of trouble. Okay? So protecting wrongdoers doesn't mean that you just say what they did was okay, and there doesn't need to be any penalty, and there's no consequences when you do wrong. That's not what is being said here. Yeah, clearly if somebody is doing something damaging, you need to curtail that person's activities. And if they can't be trusted to restrain their own activities, you may need to punish them. Not punish them, imprison them. But you're imprisoning them out of compassion, not only for would-be victims, but also for that person, because they're going to create a lot of negative karma by harming others. Okay? So that's very different than imprisoning people with the attitude of punishment. And this is, you know, one of the things I think we need to think about a lot in this country, is that we really punish, we imprison people with the idea of punishing them, and through being punished they will change. But the thing is, when people have nothing and you take something away from them, it doesn't encourage them to change at all. Yeah, because they don't have anything to start with. Yeah, they're, you know, maybe didn't get a proper education, or they were impoverished, or they, you know, were treated so poorly as a child. You know, so taking something away from a person like that does not encourage them to change. In fact, it actually increases their anger and resentment. And that's why we have the situation of people being imprisoned and then coming out of prison often more angry and thus more harmful than they were when they went in. Whereas if there was this feeling that we're imprisoning you, like to protect you from yourself, because when you harm others, you're harming yourself and creating so much negative karma. And we're trying to protect you from creating that negative karma and protect you from getting yourself in situations whereby you harm others and then you get harmed in return. Yeah? And so, you know, you like we have all these situations of these people who go on killing sprees and then are shot. Yeah? Well, if some of these people had been identified and, you know, who had committed crimes before and had been imprisoned with the idea of restraining them from their own harmful mind, then they wouldn't have reoffended and gotten themselves killed in the process of it. okay? But, you know, they really have to feel that, that the imprisonment is being done in order to help them, even though they're suffering at the time. And then show that by giving them an education and vocation and doing restorative justice so that they have some opportunity to show their regret to society and to the people that they harmed. You know, whereas if you just throw them away, throw them in the can and toss the key away, they get even more angry. Yeah, and you know, nothing really changes. Okay. Then the next verse says, a king who, Job, this is Blow, Joe Blow. A king who, I was going to say Blow Joe, Joe Blow. A king who punishes wrongdoers to protect everybody is not a wrongdoer because he is engaged in helping the good. Okay? So the king who kills somebody or imprisons them or flogs them or humiliates them is not a wrongdoer because he is engaged in helping the good. So verse 85, Aryadeva says, there is nothing that will not serve as a reason for happiness. Reasons such as scriptural statements will not destroy demerit. So what this is what it means is there's nothing that through attachment to wrong ideas we cannot twist to make it serve as a reason for happiness. Okay? So here, you know, what Joe Blow is doing is saying that the king is not a wrongdoer because he's engaged in helping the good. Yeah? So, you know, the king murders people and does that, but he's not a wrongdoer. And Aryadeva is saying, you know, you're just taking things and completely twisting them to justify and rationalize what you're doing. Okay? So he uses some other examples here. So those who enjoy being butchers say, well, this is the traditional work of my caste, and feel very happy being butchers. So just because you feel happy about something, and just because you have a reason for doing it, doesn't mean it's virtuous, doesn't mean it's wholesome and beneficial. Okay? So some Brahman treatises say that animals were created by Brahma to provide sustenance, so killing them isn't an ill deed. You know, this is also the idea in Christianity that animals were created for human beings, so it's fine to kill them. Okay? And Aryadeva is saying, just because something is found in a scripture doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Okay? Because if it's something false, and if the argumentation is false and incorrect, it still doesn't destroy the negative karma of people who do those misdeeds, even though the people think that what they're doing is good. Yeah? So for example, you know, in Nepal, they once a year, usually in the autumn, they do this mass animal sacrifice, and the people think, oh, this is so good, we're propitiating the gods and creating good karma. And just because they think that and they slaughter like thousands of animals, that doesn't mean that they're actually creating good karma. Yeah? And so, you know, similarly, you may be in a position of power and think what I'm doing is for the good of the people. But, you know, if you're mistaken, it doesn't matter what you think or what you're using to justify, it's still negative karma. Okay? So the law may be with you. You know, like with due to Citizens United, you know, you can give, you know, multi-million dollar donations and control the political process. And if you say, well, there's nothing negative in that because it's legal, that doesn't mean it's wholesome. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's a virtuous deed. Okay, so that's the point that we're getting at here. That we may rationalize negative actions we do for pleasure by using scriptures or other people's instructions. You know, my boss told me to do this, so it's not really negative. Yeah. But he's saying, no, you know, we have to think about what we do. Okay, so there's time for a few questions. Now people don't have questions.
It's just a comment, actually. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about imprisoning people to protect themselves, to protect their own minds, it just reminded me also of the reason to come to a monastery.
The reason of what?
To come to a monastery.
Oh.
You know, and once there, we may feel imprisoned sometimes, but to kind of remember that that's also the point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah. You come to a monastery to protect yourself from your own negative mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Similarly, I'm so inspired by the biography Krishnachandra's Four Dawn of the Buddha. And there was this one point when King Suddhodana asked the Buddha to take over the rulership, and the Buddha already had many issues and was famous for his awakening. The Buddha replied, "No, I will not do that because I'm now a citizen. I'm not belonging to one country or one family or one clan, and I'm not having one home. The earth is my home, and I don't earn a position. I'm a simple monk." And then he gave the teaching about how actually a county can be ruled in a positive way without probably causing so much negative karma. He was speaking about the five precepts, living in five precepts.
Mm-hmm.
I also remember that Nagarjuna and Precious Garland was speaking about how to deal, for example, when somebody is doing criminal acts, when you put him or her in a prison, and that you should not punish the people, but you should support their positive potential. So the person will also recognize that the king is not doing something bad with him and will have a positive change in his mind.
Yeah, right, right. To try and do something positive for the person.
So, Venerable, how is this, maybe I'm speaking, asking too soon of a question, but as the fourth distortion, how does the arrogance part, just to reifying the self, is that what
Okay, so how is this part about arrogance relating to seeing that what the fourth distortion of seeing what lacks a self as having a self? Because when you are arrogant, there is the very gross feeling of I, you know, a big I that's quite important. Okay? So, you know, in this chapter, he's really talking about the manifest feeling of I as you know, being conceited and arrogant and super important. Okay? So definitely seeing that there's some kind of concrete self there in a very gross form. But then the subtle self that we're grasping at, a subtler level of that, of seeing what doesn't have a self as having a self, that distortion, that's going to be refuted in chapter 9 through 16, the last eight chapters.
Because I have to say that a lot of Joe Blow's reasoning is really silly, well, stupid.
Yeah.
And I can track Arya Devish just shooting little arrows at them, but the thinking is just like trying to find every little positive opportunity to make a point about something that is so silly and has no...
Right. Yeah, so all these comments that Joe Blow is making, it seems like he's just going to extreme lengths to prove... And his reasoning is so obviously flawed, you know, that what's this guy doing? But, you know, if we look back on the first three chapters, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, oh, the body really is pure because we wash it and we decorate it with flowers and use, you know, deodorant and perfume and everything else. And, you know, things don't really change because they look exactly the same the next day. So the thing is that in one way those arguments look really silly, but in another way they're the ones that our own minds use when we are believing in these distorted conceptions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I've just got to translate how I would do this, how yeah. I would make up these.
Okay, so this is a good exercise then, you know, because maybe some of the Joe Blow's reasonings, you know, have to do with that historical period. So maybe go back and bring out your own Joe Blow this week,
yeah.
Okay, and write down some reasons that you have why you think that being in a position of power means that it's fine for you to be arrogant.
Yeah.
That would be a very good exercise.
Yeah, because this yeah. is not related to Joe Blow here.
Yeah. Well, we could still the same, you know, it's fine for me to be arrogant because I was elected by the public, so they all like me and they all trust me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or it's fine for, you know, it's right for me to be arrogant because I was appointed to this position by the shareholders. Or it's right for me to be arrogant because I'm the leader of this family and the whole family depends on me and, you know, whatever it is. Yeah. So, yeah, so go back and see the reasons, you know, that your own internal Joe Blow uses. And then we can play with that next time. Yeah?
You said that having those thoughts create a lot of negative karma.
Mm-hmm.
And I have difficulty with that because sometimes I have thought that things in my mind and scared the shit out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
I know if I don't act out, then...
Right.
But still, for that to rise in me, like, I don't know, I get...
Yeah. So sometimes it happens, and I think it's happened to all of us, that we've had thoughts that have shocked and horrified ourselves.
Ill will.
Yeah? Like some kind of hatred or ill will come up and just go, oh my God, how could I even think that thought? You know, so of course we restrain ourselves, but still it can be frightening to know that our mind is capable of even thinking like that. So what to do in that kind of situation?
How do I know that I'm not creating bad karma?
How do you know that you're not creating bad karma? That's not the question to ask. Because whether you know or don't know you're creating bad karma, or whether you are or aren't creating bad karma, still in your heart you don't want to have that thought. Isn't the thought, isn't the question, how do I subdue those kind of thoughts?
Harm.
Yeah.
So,
I don't want to create harm, so how do I subdue those thoughts? Is that the question?
When it arises, what do I do? Right there.
Confused. Okay. So, like right now. Okay, so when that thought arises, you know, I want to clobber that person. Yeah. Then you can just say, oh, that's a thought. Release it. I don't need to feed that thought. Or you can say, oh, that thought is, you know, the ripening of some kind of negative karma, and I confess that thought, and I'm never going to follow those kinds of thoughts. Yeah. And to just be honest and say, I don't want to think like that. That's not the kind of person I want to be. So I'm not following that thought. I'm not going to sit there and get all guilty for thinking it because that's going to just keep me more stuck in that thought. Like, oh, what a terrible person I had that evil thought. Oh, what a terrible person I had that bad thought. Oh, what a terrible person I thought this. That just, you know. I beg your pardon.
Or there's just a lot of analyzing, like, why did that happen? Where did that come from? And I mean, there's a lot
of... does that mean?
What does that mean, going into a wrong way, and then taking the wrong track on that kind of mind, where you really want to find an antidote rather than trying to analyze?
Yeah. Right, and just to recognize, okay, that thought, the important thing is to say, that thought came in my mind, I don't want to follow it, I don't want to be like that, and I'm shifting my attention elsewhere right now. And, you know, I can do some Vajrasattva mantra or whatever, because that might help me, you know, purify just whatever, you know, latency was there that manifested as that thought coming up at that time. Okay, but this will be the last question.
Following the question that Venerable Jump asked about a leader or a king who doesn't agree with the things that the people do, for example. Mm-hmm. What if, for example, someone, maybe a king or not, doesn't agree with the things that the people are doing, but protects them? I mean, in terms of the karma, he gets the results, he experiments the results of the karma of that action.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, for example, I am a king, and someone kills another one. Mm-hmm. Another one from another town, or mm-hmm. another kingdom. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I don't agree with that action, but mm-hmm. I protect the people who is performing that action.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, do I experiment the results of killing because I'm being his...
They're protecting. Okay, so if you're the king and one of your subjects kills somebody from another kingdom, but you protect that person, are you accumulating negative karma? I would say if you're angry, you know, and and if you are saying, well, it's kind of good that he killed that person, therefore I'm going to protect him. Because why else, you know, if you have power to govern people in a fair way, and you're doing something biased, then there's going to be a negative motivation behind it, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. And what if the original person was, if I'm protecting him because I want him to protect me, that's also a self-centered...
Well, you know, again, there's so much... It's kind of like, you know, when people are in prison or when you're in a gang, you defend the people in your gang... no matter what.
Yeah.
Even when they're wrong, you defend them. Is that wise or is that stupid?
Stupid.
It's stupid. It may protect your life, but it's still stupid. Okay? Yeah? So sacrificing our own morality to protect somebody else and to hide somebody else's crime, you can understand how, if somebody's threatened and they're terrified of their own life, how they might do that, you know. But that doesn't make it a good deed. The fact that they would be frightened and forced by circumstances, I think, would make it less negative than if they were really angry and vengeful and, you know, oh, I'm so glad I want to, you know, stick up for my teammate because I'm really glad they killed that person. You know? It certainly, if you're doing it just to protect yourself, it wouldn't be as negative as if you're really angry. Yeah, but still.
Yeah. Families do it.
Families do it, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you protect your family no matter what.
What?
You lie, you cover up.
Loyalty.
Yeah. Yeah, a wrong sense of loyalty, a distorted sense of loyalty. But we're also taught like that, aren't we?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, society really encourages us to be like that. Yeah. But it's interesting because when gang members do it, you say it's stupid. When somebody in your own family does it, you say, but we all stick together and protect each other, and we're not really good. We're not really bad people, and that person just did something that time, and they won't do it again. So we really need to protect them. Yeah. So we always have a reason a justification there. Okay. And you know, in that light, you can look at what some of the Catholic clergy did who covered up for the abusive priests, you know, because they're thinking, oh, but, you know, that priest, he also has so many good qualities. He helps so many people. This is just a small thing that's wrong. We don't want to stop him from doing all the good things he does, you know? Or they think, you know, if he's exposed, then it'll really ruin the whole reputation of the church, and many people will lose faith, and that will be very damaging to people if they lose faith. So we need to cover up to protect the reputation of the church. So, you know, you can see how people do this kind of thing, and they have some reason, which to them makes some sense, you know. So right now people are really screaming because Dolan, Timothy Dolan, is he the Archbishop now of New York? So he was in, what was it, one Michigan or somewhere?
Minnesota,
yeah, something with an M. And recommended to the church that they transfer assets of the church into a different fund because he had a feeling that there would be court cases against the church. So he wanted to protect the assets of the church. So in one way, you can look at what he does, and he's thinking, well, that was money offered by the faithful. We can use it to build a school. We can use it to build a hospital. You know, we want to protect that money. Yeah, but then you also look at it and see, but he, you know, also was covering up the ill deeds of some people that were really damaging.
Mm-hmm. When the families come seeking some sort of recompense for that behavior, that's the part that he's saying,
right.
I'm going to get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can see, I mean, when you're a leader, these are excellent examples of, like, when you're a leader, what are the situations you're presented with? And how do you deal with those things? Because, you know, whatever you do, somebody's going to be unhappy, and whatever you do, something that you care about is going to suffer. Yeah.
But you know, Venerable, the teaching that has always been really helpful for me is when you laid out the short-term benefit with the short-term suffering, the short-term benefit with the long-term suffering. That clarifies things for me so much when I think about the world and think about my own actions.
Right. But even in this one, Dolan could have said, but long term, many people in the church would suffer by losing faith. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. He could have very easily thought that.
True.
Yeah? Yeah? And then, as it turns out now, by covering up, then people, that's what's making people lose faith. Yeah? But then, if they never found out to start with, you know, that's what he's thinking, then we wouldn't have to deal with all of this. So better just kind of keep it hush-hush. Don't let anybody know. Yeah, then people don't get so upset. It's difficult. Yeah? Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Om Guru Namah Mangala Kanyataya.
to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.